having been a Marine in the invasion of Iraq, as a senior machine gunner in infantry, and having my combat badge, I always was concerned with why we're really there and about, okay, we're going to seize weapons of mass destruction, and then, oh, well, we don't know where the weapons of mass destruction are, but we're going to go in, we're going to, you know, free the tyranny over there and free the Iraqi people. Okay. I think when you brought up the points about Halliburton and Bechtel, I'd just like everybody to know that this is not the first time that the U.S. has gone in for profit. I'd like to talk about a person that most Marines are familiar with, the twice awarded Congressional Medal of Honor General Smedley Butler. Back in 1932, he was approached by representatives of the Morgan Bank, who offered to finance him to establish a dictatorship of the United States to replace the Roosevelt government in 1932. He refused and went to the press. A congressional investigation was eventually suppressed. There's a book about it. It's by Jules Archer, The Plot to Seize the White House. So there's a couple quotes I'd like to just say, and I think it relates very well to this discussion. War is just a racket. This is Smedley Butler. Testimony before the House of Representatives Committee, Investigation of the Nazi and Other Propaganda in 1935. War is just a racket. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of people. Only a small inside group knows what it's about. Halliburton, Bechtel. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the masses. And, you know, personally, I have a big problem about that. But as a Marine, especially enlisted, we just do what we're told and we follow orders. That's pretty much all I want to say.
Professor Bell.
I want to look at, I guess, the domestic aspect of this problem. During the Vietnam era, numerous students such as yourself are sitting in this class protest about the atrocities that were occurring during the 60s and 70s. With so many citizens not in agreement with this war, Dr. Parenti, why do you think there are such an apathy amongst today's students?
The primary one is that there is no draft, so it's not an immediate threat. The deeper reason is that we've all had our minds colonized to a certain extent, where we don't see ourselves as really connected to other people. You know, we see ourselves as monads, as like truly autonomous individuals that aren't really dependent on society, when in fact we are all bound up in this together. But our society is always telling us overtly and sort of subtextually in stories and in political messages that the most important thing is the individual, the only real category of analysis is the individual, freedom only takes place for individuals. So it becomes hard for people to see the real connections that we all have to each other and therefore take responsibility and feel connected to what's unfolding in Iraq. So it becomes, in other words, easier to just say, who cares if they kill everyone in Iraq, to lack empathy because one falsely imagines themselves to be outside of and above the lives of the collective. But Brooks' comments touched on the theme that I wanted to ask the panel about, which is this question of disobedience. And the reason I said it was an honor to be on a panel with vets was precisely because I think that the opposition to this war domestically has to be led by veterans and their families. And part of the reason I went to Iraq was at the time of the Afghan war, there was developing among journalists and intellectuals a strange type of fetishization about experience. If you didn't go to these places, you didn't really have a legitimate critique. The primary purveyors of this, I felt, were Michael Ignatieff and David Reif and others like that, who had tremendous authority because they took risks and they went to Afghanistan, and then that informed their position. I know other journalists felt the same way. Naomi Klein went to Iraq for the same reason. We weren't going to let anyone silence us and say, well, you know, you weren't there, you don't know, you don't have a right to critique. It doesn't matter if you read the entire history of U.S. intervention and can make some superb watertight argument about that. If you don't go and get some dust in your mouth, then you don't know. That same kind of obsession with authenticity and the role of immediate experience gives veterans a tremendous power. When a veteran says, this war is wrong, we've been lied to, it's very hard for people who support the war to just dismiss them. And that's why I think it's really important, the role of veterans in opposing the war. So this brings up this question of disobedience. And I found it really interesting in talking to vets, the role of the type of emotional blackmail that the volunteer military, the post-Vietnam volunteer military, has achieved over people. You don't have to like the war. You don't have to agree with the president. You don't have to do anything. You're free to think whatever you want. But you signed a contract, and you have a job to do. All you have to do is deliver your body. Your mind can do whatever you want, or your political component of your mind, your political emotions. but your body has to be focused on the task at hand. And there's this idea of obligation, that you sign a contract, and that that's more important than anything else. And I know of a number of vets, I suspect that there are a few on this panel, who disagree with the war, but say they would go back if told to, because of the obligation of having signed this contract. The most famous is Rykov, who was from Massachusetts, very outspoken, articulate, young lieutenant who was a Democrat and was early on in condemning the war, but said, if called back, I will go. And in a way, it made sense tactically because he was debating right-wingers and he was in the national media, and he was sort of just trying to cut off the right wing, you know, and say, I'm such a loyal American that I'll go die for a war that I disagree in. But it's gotten to the point where we have to really problematize that. And so my question, I guess, to the panel is, have you guys thought about this question of disobedience? At what point does the Smedley-Butler path, at what point is mutiny the obligation? At what point is obedience to your contract disobedience to your species and to humanity? It's not a question with an easy answer, but I think it's the one we have to actually start dealing with. And that's why I dealt with Camilo Mejia at the end, because he disobeyed. And he went AWOL and went to jail for it. So
you signed a contract. It's not the Boy Scouts. I'm going to tell you about my experience. I was in Iraq during the war. I spent 22 years affiliated with the Marine Corps, 4 years active, 18 reserve. I have no doubt in my mind that what we did there was good. I saw mass graves. I saw torture chambers in the prisons. I saw covert chambers in basements of stores that were turned into torture chambers. These are things that I saw, massive graves with thousands of bodies. And while we're all a collection of experiences and we all have opinions, I know that what I did there was I saved lives, both American and Iraqi. And I'm glad that you mentioned that there are people from that region who are not Iraqis, both Yemenis nationals that I dealt with, Saudi nationals from all over coming in there because of the deep hatred that they have. And those people are socialized at a very young age because of the lack of education and the control that the government had to have a deep embedded hatred for us. And I've never had any doubt or an inclination to disobey. That never came across my mind.
So you basically,
and that's as a Marine.
Right.
As a Marine.
So you agree with the war. That's why you...
I agree with what my participation in the war was. I know that what I did was right.
Right. Do you think that the entire war is marked by that same level?
No war is perfect. I mean, the question that you're asking right now is flawed.
Well, no, it's not.
Perfect. There will be innocent people killed. There'll be atrocities. That's what war is all about.
I know that. Yeah. You wouldn't disobey because you agree with the war, basically. But I know there are many soldiers who disagree with the war, but would still go back. And this is what I don't understand.
Let me interject something here. And I'm paraphrasing when I say this here, but Thomas Jefferson said that, you know, it would be considered unpatriotic of citizens not to question the actions of his government. And for us not to question the actions of our government, especially when we have been deceived, is ludicrous. Not the rapper, but actually ludicrous. I was in the first Gulf War as well. I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of. But knowing the information after the fact, I felt deceived. Now, you and I both know this, Sandy, you know this as well, that you know, as a devil dog, we kick ass and take names. You point in the direction, we're going to follow those orders unconditionally. But once those orders have been somewhat based on deception, based on deceit, for ill-gotten gain, just to interject what you were saying about Halliburton, that was a no-bid contract of billions of dollars. No other corporation could compete against Halliburton. Halliburton got this money given to them with no other corporation competing for that same work. So when you say to yourself that as a Marine, yes, if I was in that situation, you damn Skippy, it's either me or you, and I'm going to do what I'm exactly told. But after the fact, have an opportunity to reflect upon this here, I wouldn't feel good about killing people that should not have been killed in the first place. Because when it comes down to it, they train us for the sole purpose of doing what we do best. Where we're the last one to know, the first one to go as Marines. And I think that my actions in the first Persian Gulf made me realize that it's more things to do than just want to support some ill-gotten gains to some corporation to support their wealth. If you understand the history of something, ladies and gentlemen, like the Daharan Agreement, which was made between Saudi Arabia with FDR and numerous other presidents thereafter, you can understand why we're not going up against Saudi Arabia and we decide to go against Afghanistan or Iraq. Know your history before you start speaking about your so-called facts. Thank you.
But have any of you thought about this question of, like, at what level would you go back? At what level would you say, I have to disobey, I have to break this contract, I have to violate the sense of honor that goes with the whole idea of pledging to do something in a contract. At what level does that happen?
As people in the military, we don't have the choice. Otherwise, we go to jail, like your friend did. And so we do what we're told, and we do what we're trained to do, and we do it for our friends, and we do it to go back home to our families. You know, whether or not we believe in it, we're all ants. We're just pawns in this game. And we just do what we need to do and, you know, complete the mission so we can go home.
I understand, you know, why soldiers fight. That's obvious, you know. But when it gets to the point of, like, agreeing to publicly state, you know, to get out of the situation, to develop a critique of the war, not of your own situation, but to see the larger picture, and then to say, but I'm still going to value this contract. My question is, like, what is this hold that the contract has over people's imagination? It's just amazing. And I know that Iraqi vets, you know, who are organized against the war come up against this a lot, that a lot of veterans who don't like the war feel like they'd be dissing their comrades if they spoke out against the policy. So it seems like people can't separate between the policy and the soldiers who are forced to pursue the policy. And in terms of this question of disobedience, I would just remind you that American history is full of examples of disobedience, right? It's born out of disobedience. I mean, a revolution, women have the right to vote because they disobeyed the law and demanded the right to vote and had sit-ins. De facto segregation ended because people violated the law and obeyed a higher law. I think it's going to come to that, actually, in this war. I think that it's going to take that, and I think that it is going to happen. If we keep on this for 3 years, which will happen, there are going to be a lot of dead and maimed soldiers, and it's going to be harder and harder to point to the crimes of Saddam Hussein, which are multiple, but unfortunately which were supported by the U.S. You know, 1983, December 29th, 1983, Donald Rumsfeld shook hands with Saddam Hussein. The U.S. supported Iraq in the war against Iran because, recall that Iran had just taken hostages in 1979. They'd had this theocratic revolution. It was seen as a threat to U.S. power in the region, and they wanted to bleed Iran, and so they supported Iraq with $5 billion worth of loans. While our government was doing that with our taxes, Saddam, with the knowledge of our government, not the direct approval of our government, but with the knowledge of our government, was pursuing his genocidal campaign against the Kurds, the Anfal campaign, in which he used gas against the Kurds and created these mass graves. But see, our government knew about that and did nothing at the time. So as U.S. casualties mount, as the situation there stays in this holding pattern or goes down, declines, I think more and more soldiers and the people who are related to them and go to school with them are going to have to confront this question of when is disobedience the right thing to do.
I think your analysis of what happened before and during and what's going on now is important, and I think the discussion is important. But when I sign that contract, I sign with the faith in my government that if called upon, I will serve. And then that discussion, if there's a question as to why I was there, needs to take place after the fact. And I think if we question every single movement or campaign that the government has, we wouldn't have the military that we have now. And like I said, your discussion and your analysis is important. And I think it's important that we have the discussion. But when I sign the contract, I sign the contract with full faith that if called upon, I will go.
Can I add to that? I think obligation might be the wrong word. It's when you join the military, you gain the sense of duty, that you have that uniform on and you are so proud. And I think a sense of duty is a better word than an obligation. You know, you sign a contract, yes. And everyone who does sign a contract understands the circumstances that they might go to war. I might go to war. I went to war. You know, I went to Iraq for a year. So I think a sense of duty and country and brotherhood is a better term than obligation. So.
Yeah, but the question is, when does that get flipped and transformed, and when do you experience the duty and obligation as being, like, in the interests of my comrades, I have to disobey. I have to be the brave one who risks being ridiculed by the larger society and say, no, I'm not going along with this, you know, because I care about, among other things, these people I'm in this unit with, and they're going to fight for an unjust cause, and many of them will be killed and maimed, and I cannot endorse that and be part of that because I'm loyal to them.
Let me just interject something as well. During the Vietnam era, there was a lot of so-called lawful orders, and it turns out that a lot of those so-called lawful orders was quite unlawful. And what happened, right, they placed on a contract of numerous servicemen such as myself a line called conscientious objector. Are you totally against any war? Are you totally against killing someone? Now, don't get me wrong. I signed, hey, I have no problems. And being a Marine, I enjoyed doing what I did, regardless of what my sense of duty or obligation was. But you have to realize and say to yourself that I'm reflecting upon my history as a Marine. Now, if I was in the Marine Corps, if my staff sergeant, my gunny say, hey, let's kick ass and take name, I'm not questioning that. But the point being is that there's numerous veterans such as myself still feel somewhat, I guess, embarrassed, for lack of a better word, of what they did based on the orders of so-called lawful individuals. Now, while you're in there in that gun battle or whatever situation may be, you're going to do whatever you have to do. But once you retire and realize that what you did may have been unethical, we have to sleep with that. The American people talking about this liberty and constitution and all the other stuff, well, each one of you guys that's clapping should be over there fighting as well. Because you're not going to make that decision. For me, and I'm not trying to be pro-Bush or anti-Bush, no whatsoever, but for me to have you in the crosshairs and squeeze that trigger, damn it, we better be right. And that's all what I'm saying. Thank you.
And the question, of course, is that what happens when we're not right? And that's the question that we're all confronting now as the situation spirals out of control, as each promise they give us falls flat. First, it was a transition of authority. That'll end the war. Everything will be better. Didn't happen. Constitution, that's going to end the war. It's not going to end the war. Nothing's getting better. Apparently, the project was not right. I would submit, I have submitted to you for your consideration tonight, that possibility, that it's been a lie, and it's about pursuing domination of the planet and the direct profit of Bush-connected firms. And so this is the question. If that's true, you don't have to believe it, but if that's true, then that poses a set of very difficult questions. How does one maintain a sense of duty and loyalty to the principles that your country supposedly stands for while bucking the entire system? I mean, I think that one of the most powerful things beyond jail is ridicule. The idea that underneath it, if you disobey, you're a coward, or that you don't care about other people. And people who do disobey and are going to disobey have to stand up against all that. And that's all. I just wanted to begin the discussion of that, because I think it's never, ever discussed, this notion of duty and how we articulate duty. Why is the duty to the contract? Why is the duty not to the interests of the nation, not as defined by the Bush administration, but as defined by the majority of people in this country?
I think at our level, as individuals in the military, it's beyond us. I think we all need to be together and shout out in one voice. And we need to have the backing of our congresspeople and our senators. And otherwise, I mean, I have future plans and, you know, I want to have a wonderful life. And if I were to not do what is in my contract, then I think my future would be destroyed, my reputation. So as an individual, I'm not going to be able to stand up and say, this war is wrong, because who am I? All of us need to do it together if we're going to do it. And we need to have the backing of our congresspeople and our senators.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So, well, maybe we should put to rest this question of duty. And do you have any other questions for me?
I have a question for you. What do you think about our international reputation? What do other European or Asian nations stand about our actions in this campaign?
Well, I think that the U.S. has lost a lot of credibility. It's seen the rest of the world sees this war much more in the way that I've laid it out tonight, that it was based on lies and that it's about the accumulation of political power for the U.S. state and economic power for U.S. corporations. And beyond that, they see it as just tremendously dangerous and reckless and misguided, and that it has no clear ending, and that the threats of instability are much greater than they were before the war, that the threat of terrorism is much greater than it was before the war. This is how the Brits see it. They see, you know, not all Brits, but many Brits see the bombings in the London subway of several months ago as a direct result of the British participation in Iraq. The Spaniards see the bombing of Madrid, Spain, as being a direct result of this war. So a lot of the world is very worried. They're scared for their own safety, and they're angry at the U.S. for having started this. They feel that they're going to have to pay the price.
I want to respond to Brooke when he said, what can an individual do? A great lady just died this week. She was an individual who sat on the bus and says, not today, I'm not giving up my seat. One individual started that. So individuals could do a lot. I have one question to get away from Iraq. I want to go to Afghanistan. Do you see that election as being successful? And if you do, to what degree?
Yeah, the elections in Afghanistan are very different from the elections in Iraq. They're nowhere near as legitimate. The situation in Afghanistan is It's a very multi-ethnic society, still very underdeveloped, very tribal in its political organization. And there have been for 20, 30 years, the traditional local leaders who fought against the Soviets, in many cases worked with the Soviets when the Soviets used the same methodology that the U.S. used in its war, which is to just buy off the local leadership and say, we'll give you money if you don't attack us. And they're like, okay. And then when the Taliban came along, these local leaders did the same thing. Now that there's been elections, these are the people, by and large, who are in the newer Afghan parliament. There's been block voting, massive fraud, and in many cases, no real competition at the local level. These villages are arranged in hierarchical structures of allegiance to these warlords, and so it's obvious that those warlords will be elected. So thus you have people like the guy who was a Taliban commander, who was the Taliban commander, who led the destruction of those large Buddhist statues. You know, that Afghanistan was a Buddhist society before the advent of Islam, and so there are these ancient Buddhist statues, huge, huge Buddhas, and the Taliban, being Sunni fundamentalists, thought this was idolatry, and so this guy destroyed these beautiful artifacts of human history. He's now in the new government instead of in jail. So this is the kind of stuff that happens. And you have, you know, Rashid Dostum, who was a warlord who worked both with the U.S. and with the Soviet Union and was known for doing stuff like strapping people to tanks and grinding them up. He did this practically in front of Ahmed Rashid, one of the most famous journalists from that region. You know, he's in the government, Karzai's government, so there's no real democracy in Afghanistan, from what I could tell when I was there for the presidential elections last time around.
We have a couple of faculty members that have questions.
I wanted to address what you said about the next president. Many public opinion polls are showing that there's a growing discontent in the population about the war. Why do you think so strongly that a mildly anti-war candidate from the Democratic Party couldn't win, or that the policy would basically be the same?
Well, I mean, I think that they could. I just think that the Democrats would be too scared to do that. I mean, I think that a Democrat who had an anti-war position, a creative anti-war position, and had a class program of redistribution, had politics more along the lines of Howard Dean, where he named the Bush tax cuts, problematized this welfare for the rich, and talked about how to create jobs through taxing the wealthy and redistributing wealth and rebuilding infrastructure. I think a person like that could do very well, but I don't think the Democrats will do that. One, they're not all together entirely unhappy about much of the Bush agenda, because many Democrats have fairly right-wing politics. But I think they have a pathological fear of being called unpatriotic. Why don't they articulate some sort of opposition to the war? When they do, it's like what John Kerry said, though, several days ago. It was like that, oh, we should draw down troops, but we should stay there. And it doesn't make any sense. It's just like this weaker version of what the Bush administration is doing. And it doesn't resonate with anybody. So,
Gina?
When you were talking about formulating the policy, the center that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
I don't hear anything about George Bush. And I was wondering how much of a role he actually plays.
Well, I don't...
The question I have is whether or not it's possible to continue our present course of action without the instituting the draft.
I think Bush ultimately has to make the decisions. I don't think he's just a puppet, but I do think that the heavy intellectual lifting comes from this group that was in place articulating these things beforehand. George Bush wasn't part of the Project on a New American Century. He wasn't formulating this vision. He understands it. He ultimately had to pull the trigger on it. But the reason I was talking about these others is because they have a decade-long published record of what their position is. My impression is that the military doesn't want a draft, that they saw the draft as disastrous for the war in Vietnam, and that would not solve the problem for them in Iraq, that they would have serious morale problems, they would have a bunch of unwilling soldiers. I mean, now American soldiers, as people here have articulated, are incredibly well-motivated, even when disagreeing with the larger policy. I mean, the U.S. military is very highly trained and gets the job done even when they disagree with the policy. In Vietnam, that was, I think, one of the key things that allowed, towards the end, mass disobedience, is that people hadn't volunteered for it. They could say, not only do I disagree with this, the only reason I'm here is because I was threatened with prison if I didn't come here. And then the whole thing fell apart as a result of that. You know, 800 officers were killed by their men in Vietnam from fragging. By the end, the whole thing fell apart, and the military sees that as the product of the draft. So I don't think they want a draft, actually. One thing about the previous question, what an anti-war candidate would have to do is be branded themselves and have the party branded with defeat, with very serious imperial defeat. And that's the nature of the project. It wouldn't just be like getting out of an unpopular war. I mean, what would it mean long-term for the U.S.? And I think that the Democrats agree that the price would be too high. I think they're being honest, those right-wing Democrats like Kerry and Schumer and others, and they say the price would be too high, we cannot leave. They mean it. They think that the U.S. would be set back for decades to come.
I just want to comment on the issue of obedience. There's a conflict between the value of loyalty and justice. And I think in many contexts, the higher value of justice should take priority or precedence over loyalty. And I would very strongly urge the members of the military establishment to learn the lessons from the Nuremberg trials, in which the appeal to loyalty did not succeed in absolving the members from ethical responsibility for participating directly or indirectly in war crimes.
It is clear to me, and I wonder if you, this is what I'd like to ask you about, that the long-term strategic interest of the United States is having the war continue in Iraq to drain Shiite power and prevent Iraq aligning with our new enemy, which is Iran.
No, I don't think that the war is draining Shiite power. I think the war is creating a vacuum into which the Shiite have stepped. I don't think that this vacuum is particularly good for the U.S. I think it's much better for Iran in some ways. And there's a tendency among critics of the war to sometimes want to see too much coherence in every detail of the war. We were talking about this earlier this morning about the Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena. She was kidnapped and then she was liberated by paying ransom from the Italian intelligence service to her kidnappers. And then as she was being driven to the airport, a U.S. patrol, U.S. traffic stop, opened up on her vehicle. Many people thought, oh, this was planned to silence her because she was a critic of the war. I don't believe that, and it didn't make any sense. And first of all, let's say you did want to silence her. Well, you would hire Iraqi assassins to do it. You wouldn't have some U.S. patrol do it.
Okay, now our press.
Thank you very much. My name is Joe Sacco, and I'm with Las Vegas Indie Media. Amy Goodman of democracynow.org often refers to the embedded journalist as being in bed with the media, government officials of the United States.
Certainly in bed with the media. But yeah.
Now, my question is, one of the underreported issues that goes with the military and the occupation is the use of depleted uranium in this engagement. And as you are aware, I'm sure, depleted uranium is poisoning our young soldiers, women and men of our country, and as well Iraqi people, and as well it's poisoning the earth.
Depleted uranium is very hard, and you guys presumably know this, it's used in armor-piercing munitions and also in armor. And it's usually very inert. It has background radiation that's higher than most substances, and that's probably a bit dangerous. But the real danger is when it is vaporized, when a vehicle that has DU armor gets hit, and there's that moment of vaporization. And then depleted uranium, being very heavy, stays fairly locally around the vehicle. But yeah, it most likely one of the many sources behind the Gulf War syndrome, the breakdown of the immune systems of many veterans from the first Gulf War. The presumably other ingredients in creating Gulf War syndrome were experimental vaccines that many soldiers were given, and you know, a whole cocktail of things. But clearly some of that has to do with exposure to depleted uranium, which once it's vaporized is breathed as dust and then lodges in the body, and sometimes resides there for years doing nothing, and sometimes starts destroying the victim in all sorts of ways. And my understanding is that depleted uranium is so thoroughly integrated into the U.S. arsenal that it would be impossible to remove it, even if they did have a program to address it to do that.
And what impact has this had on the citizens, or more importantly, the children of Iraq?
Yeah, leukemia rates in Iraq have gone up multiple fold. Leukemia, brain cancer, types of cancer associated with uranium exposure are rife. But yeah, that's one of the things in not only Iraq, but in former Yugoslavia and Afghanistan, problems and legacies of U.S. intervention that will be there for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, I'm going to
water supply.
Invite Dr. Parenti now if he wants to make any closing remarks.
It's been a pleasure to be here. And returning to this question of duty, I would not want anyone to leave here thinking that the only and primary duty is the duty of the soldiers to resist. We're all responsible, even if we don't agree with this war and even if no one consulted us on it, we pay for it. And it happens only with our consent. It's hard to understand what's going on. It's hard to get good news, but it is our responsibility to understand and to resist. And just as I was implicitly in my questioning encouraging soldiers to resist and disobey, the same responsibility, I think, lies on all of us citizens to find ways of saying, no, I will not cooperate with the destruction, the continued destruction of another country, of potentially of a whole region, of an expensive process in which large corporations get rich while my peers get maimed and killed, and where thousands of other people who will never know the names of in this country, innocent Iraqis, are also killed by the process that has been unleashed, the civil war that has been unleashed, the crime wave that has been unleashed. So we all bear that responsibility to find ways to resist and not go along with policies that we disagree with. So thank you very much for coming out. Good luck.
You have been listening to a lecture and discussion given by Dr. Christian Parenti at the Community College of Southern Nevada on November 2nd of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, ShareAlike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us or WMRW Warren. Next, testimony from an independent journalist.
If Jesus came to America, he would be deported. He would have no trial and it wouldn't be reported.
Dar Jamal, keynote speaker at the People as the Media Grassroots Independent Media Conference at Palomar College, San Marcos, California, on July 30, 2005.
I'm going to give you the presentation that I gave to the World Tribunal on Iraq, the culminating session in Istanbul, Turkey. For those who don't know, which is perhaps no fault of your own, since the World Tribunals have been effectively censored from corporate media in this country from the very beginning, the World Tribunal is essentially an ongoing series of meetings that have took place around the world. For the duration of the occupation, there were 20 different world tribunals throughout the globe, one even in New York City. And it's essentially a people's movement to bring the truth of what's happening in Iraq, all the violations of international law, bring this to light, present it to the people so that the evidence is there. And from every aspect of the invasion and occupation that you can think of, from the use of uranium munitions and other illegal weapons, to violations of international law, to the failures of the UN, to the cultural destruction that's taking place and has taken place in Iraq, really just about anything you can think of has been covered. And so the culminating session that occurred at the end of June in Istanbul really took bits from every single one of the tribunals that had taken place before it. And it's a huge movement, and it got really incredible press. In Turkey, for example, it was headline news while it was going on. All of their national television stations and their big newspapers covered it, as did so many other countries around the world. There were 130 journalists there from around the world. And, of course, the big glaring omission was folks from, for example, CNN or NBC or CBS, which really isn't a big surprise when we look at how the whole invasion has been covered. So I was asked to show up and provide testimony about the situation of torture in Iraq, as well as look at the state of the healthcare system in Iraq under occupation, and then provide an overview of the situation on the ground there today, a little bit over 2 years into the occupation. So that's what I'm going to present to you. So to start with my testimony, in May of 2004, I interviewed a man who had just been released from Abu Ghraib. Like so many I interviewed from various U.S. military detention facilities who'd been tortured horrifically, he still managed to maintain his sense of humor. He began laughing when telling me how CIA agents made him beat other prisoners. He laughed, he said, because he had been beaten himself prior to this and was so tired that all he could do to beat other detained Iraqis was lift his arm and let it drop on the other men. Later, he laughed again as he told me what else had been done to him when he said, "The Americans brought electricity to my ass before they brought it to my house." But this testimony is not about the indomitable spirit of the Iraqi people. About the dignity and strength of Iraqis, we need no testimony. This testimony is about ongoing violations of international law being committed by the occupiers of Iraq on a daily basis in regards to rampant torture, the neglect and obstruction of the healthcare sector, and the ongoing failure to allow Iraqis to reconstruct their infrastructure. To discuss torture, there are so many stories I could use here, but I'll use two examples indicative of scores of others I documented in my time in Iraq. Ali Abbas lives in the Al-Amariya district of Baghdad and worked in civil administration. So many of his neighbors were detained that friends urged him to go to the nearby U.S. base to try and get answers for why so many innocent people were detained. He went three times. On the fourth time, he was detained himself. Within 2 days, he was transferred from the military base to Abu Ghraib, where he was held over 3 months without charges before being released. "The minute I got there, the suffering began," said Abbas about his interrogator. "I asked him for water, and he said after the investigation I would get some. He accused me of so many things and asked me so many questions. Among them, he said I hated Christians." He was forced to strip naked shortly after arriving, and remained that way for most of his stay in the prison. "They made us lay on top of each other naked as if it was sex and beat us with a broom," he said. In addition to being beaten on their genitals, detainees were also denied water and food for extended periods of time, then were forced to watch as their food was thrown in the trash. Treatment also included having a loaded gun held to his head to prevent him from crying out in pain as his hand ties were tightened. "My hands were enlarged because there was no blood because they cuffed them so tight," he told me. "My head was covered with a sack, and they fastened my right hand to a pole with handcuffs. They made me stand on my toes to clip me to it." Abbas said soldiers doused him in cold water while holding him under a fan, and oftentimes, quote, "they put on a loudspeaker, put the speakers on my ears, and said, 'Shut up. In this manner, Abbas's interrogators routinely deprived him of sleep. Abbas said that at one point, quote, "two men came, one a foreigner and one a translator. He asked me who I was. I said, 'I am a human being.' They told me, 'We are going to cut your head off and send you to hell. We will take you to Guantanamo.' A female soldier told him, 'Our aim is to put you in hell so you will tell the truth. These are the orders we have from our superiors to turn your lives into hell.'" Abbas added, "they shit on us, used dogs against us, used electricity, and starved us." He told me, "Saddam Hussein used to have people like those who tortured us. Why do they put Saddam into trial, but they do not put the Americans to trial?" But unlike Saddam Hussein, the U.S. interrogators also desecrated Islam as part of their humiliation. Abbas was made to fast during the first day of Eid, the breaking of the fast of Ramadan, which is haram, forbidden. Sometimes at night, when he would read his Quran, Abbas had to hold it in the hallway for light. Soldiers would walk by and kick the Holy Quran, and sometimes they would try to piss on it or wipe shit on it, he said. Abbas did not feel this was the work of a few individual soldiers. Quote, "this was organized. It wasn't just individuals, and every one of the troops in Abu Ghraib was responsible for it." Accounts by human rights groups support this. According to an April 2005 Human Rights Watch report, Abu Ghraib was only the tip of the iceberg. It's now clear that abuse of detainees has happened all over, from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay to a lot of third country dungeons where the U.S. has sent prisoners, and probably quite a few other places we don't even know about. The report adds, "harsh and coercive interrogation techniques, such as subjecting detainees to painful stress positions and extended sleep deprivation, have been routinely used in detention centers throughout Iraq. an ICRC report concluded that in military intelligence sections of Abu Ghraib, methods of physical and psychological coercion used by the interrogators appeared to be part of the standard operating procedures by military intelligence personnel to obtain confessions and extract information. Amnesty International has also released similar findings. Other human rights groups report that U.S. military doctors, nurses, and medics have been complicit in torture and other illegal procedures, such as those administered to Sadiq Zoman. 55-year-old Zoman, detained from his home in Kirkuk and arrayed by U.S. soldiers that produced no weapons, was taken to a police office in Kirkuk to the Kirkuk Airport Detention Center, the Tikrit Airport Detention Center, and finally to the 28th Combat Support Hospital, where he was treated by Dr. Michael Hodges, a lieutenant colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Hodges' medical report listed Zoman's primary condition as hypoxic brain injury, brain damage caused by lack of oxygen, with persistent vegetative state, myocardial infarction, heart attack, and heat stroke. After 1 month in custody, Zoman was dropped off in a coma at the General Hospital in Tikrit by U.S. soldiers. Zoman's last name was listed as his first name on the report, despite the fact that all of his identification papers were taken during the raid on his home. Because of this, it took his desperate family weeks to locate him in the hospital. Hodges' medical report did not mention the fact that the back of Zoman's head was bashed in, nor that he had electrical burn marks on the bottoms of his feet and genitals, or why he had lash marks across his back and chest. Today, he lies in bed still in a coma, and there has been no compensation provided to his now impoverished family for what was done to Sadiq Zoman. Another aspect I shall discuss is the catastrophic situation of the health system in Iraq. I've recently released a report on the condition of Iraq's hospitals under occupation. Although the Iraq Ministry of Health has supposedly gained its sovereignty and received promises of over $1 billion of U.S. funding, hospitals in Iraq continue to face ongoing medicine, equipment, and staffing shortages under the U.S.-led occupation. During the 1990s, medical supplies and equipment were constantly in short supply because of the sanctions against Iraq. The war and occupation brought promises of relief from effects of the sanctions, yet hospitals have had little chance to recover and resupply. Instead, the occupation has closely resembled a low-grade war since its inception. In addition, allocation of resources by occupation authorities has been dismal. Thus, throughout Baghdad, there are ongoing shortages of functional equipment and medicines of even the most basic items, such as analgesics, antibiotics, anesthetics, and insulin. Surgical items and even basic supplies like rubber gloves, gauze, and medical tape are running out. In April of 2004, an ICRC report stated that hospitals in Iraq are overwhelmed with new patients, short of medicine and supplies, and lack both adequate electricity and water, with ongoing bloodshed stretching the hospital's already meager resources to the limit. Ample testimony from medical practitioners confirms this crisis. A general practitioner at the prosthetics workshop at Al-Kina Hospital in Baghdad, Dr. Thamiz Aziz Abdul Rahman, said, 11 months ago, we submitted an emergency order for prosthetic materials to the Ministry of Health, and still we have nothing. After a pause, he added, this is worse than even during the sanctions. Dr. Qasim al-Nuaisri, the chief manager of Shuadar General Hospital, one of the two hospitals in the sprawling slum area of Sadr City, Baghdad, and home to 3 million people, added that they too faced a shortage of most supplies, and most critically of ambulances. But for his hospital, the lack of potable water was the major problem. Of course we have typhoid, cholera, kidney stones, but we now even have the very rare hepatitis type E, and it has become common in our area, said al-Nuaisri, adding that they never faced these problems prior to the invasion of 2003. Shuadar Hospital needs at least 2,000 liters of water per day to function with basic sterilization practices. According to Dr. al-Nuaisri, they receive 15% of this amount. The rest of the water is contaminated and causing problems as are the electricity cuts, added Al-Nuayshri. Without electricity, our instruments in the operating room cannot work, and we have no pumps to bring us water. At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Ahmed, who asked that only his first name be used because he feared U.S. military reprisals, said of the April 2004 siege that, quote, "The Americans shot out the lights in the front of our hospital. They prevented doctors from reaching the emergency unit at the hospital, and we quickly began to run out of supplies and much-needed medications." He also said that Marines kept the physicians in the residence building several times, intentionally prohibiting them from entering the hospital in order to treat patients. In November, shortly after leveling Nizal Emergency Hospital, U.S. forces entered Fallujah General Hospital, the city's only health care facility for trauma victims, detaining employees and patients alike. According to medics on the scene, water and electricity were cut off, ambulances targeted or confiscated by the U.S. military, and surgeons, without exception, kept out of the besieged city. Hospital raids by U.S. military and U.S.-backed Iraqi forces now appear to be standard operating procedure. On the 18th of June, doctors at the main hospital in Bakuba went on strike, saying they were fed up with constant abuse at the hands of aggressive Iraqi police and soldiers. Dr. Mohammed Hazem in Bakuba pleaded for his governor to protect he and his colleagues from, quote, "organized terrorism of the police and army." When wounded Iraqi security forces showed up demanding treatment, Dr. Hussein told one of them he would require an x-ray. The doctor was told to go to hell by the policeman he was treating and was then beaten. The same policeman then ordered another police officer to put a bag over the doctor's head and take him away. Our security guards tried to stop them, telling them I was a doctor, but they didn't listen and beat the security guards too, he said. Then one of them put a gun to my head and threatened me. Similar behavior has been reported during the recent U.S.-Iraqi military operations in Haditha and Al-Qaim. Doctors also recently went on strike at the large Yarmouk Hospital in Baghdad in a very similar incident. Many doctors in Iraq believe that the lack of assistance, if not outright hostility by the U.S. military, coupled with the lack of rebuilding and reconstruction by foreign contractors, has compounded the problems they are facing. The former ambassador of Iraq, Paul Bremer, admitted that U.S.-led coalition spending on the Iraqi health system was inadequate when he said, "It's not nearly enough to cover the needs in the healthcare field." When asked if his hospital had received assistance from the U.S. military or reconstruction contractors, Dr. Sarmad Rahim, the administrator of chief doctors at Al-Kirk Hospital in Baghdad, said, "Never, ever. Some soldiers came here 5 months ago and asked what we needed. We told them and they never brought us one single needle. We heard that some people from the CPA came here, but they never did anything for us." At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Muhammad said there has been virtually no assistance from foreign contractors. And of the U.S. military, he commented, "They send only bombs, not medicine." International aid has been stymied by the horrendous security situation in Iraq. After the UN headquarters was bombed in Baghdad in August 2003, killing 22 people, aid agencies and NGOs either reduced their staffing or pulled out entirely. With senior Iraqi doctors fleeing Iraq en masse for fear of being kidnapped, interns and younger doctors are left to deal with the catastrophic situation. The World Health Organization last year warned of a health emergency in Baghdad, as well as throughout Iraq, if current conditions persist. But despite claims from the Ministry of Health of more drugs, better equipment, and generalized improvement, doctors on the ground still see, quote, "no such improvement." In conclusion, a quick summary of the overall situation on the ground in Iraq is in order. Over 2 years into the illegal occupation, while Iraq sits upon a sea of oil, ongoing gasoline shortages plague Iraqis who sometimes wait 2 days to fill their cars. In a country where a long gas line once meant a one-car wait, Iraqis who are lucky enough to afford it now purchase black market petrol and hope that it is not watered down. Electricity remains in short supply. Most of Iraq, including the northern region, receives on average 3 hours of electricity per day amidst the nearly non-existent reconstruction efforts. Even the better areas of Baghdad receive only 6 to 8 hours per day, forcing those who can afford them to use small generators to run fans and refrigerators in their homes. Of course, this is only for those who've been able to obtain the now rarefied gasoline. The security situation is, needless to say, horrendous, with over 100,000 Iraqis killed thus far, and the number of U.S. soldiers killed approaching 2,000, the violence only continues to escalate. Since the new Iraqi so-called government was sworn in this past April, well over 2,000 Iraqis and over 300 U.S. soldiers have died in the violence. These numbers will only continue to escalate as the failed occupation grinds on. As the heavy-handed tactics of the U.S. military persist, the Iraqi resistance continues to grow in its number and lethality. As I mentioned before, potable water remains in short supply. Cholera, typhoid, and other waterborne diseases are rampant, even in parts of the capital city, as lack of reconstruction continues to plague Iraq's infrastructure. Raw sewage is common not just Baghdad, but other cities throughout Iraq. With 70% unemployment, a growing resistance, and an infrastructure in shambles, the future for Iraq remains bleak as long as the failed occupation persists. While the Bush administration continues to disregard calls for a timetable for withdrawal, Iraqis continue to suffer and die with little hope for their future. With each passing day, the catastrophe in Iraq resembles the U.S. debacle in Vietnam more and more. Dr. Wamid Omar Nathmi, a senior political scientist at Baghdad University, told me last winter during an interview, "It will take Iraqis something like a quarter of a century to rebuild their country, to heal their wounds, to reform their society, to bring about some sort of national reconciliation, democracy, and tolerance of each other. But that promise will not begin until the U.S. occupation of Iraq ends."
Independent journalist Dar Jamal reprising his testimony before the International People's Tribunal on Iraq for an audience in San Marcos, California, last summer.
I'm going to read from Supporting the Troops, A Dilemma with Many Questions. This was written by Dr. John Marciano, and Dr. Marciano is Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York at Cortland and co-author of Lessons of the Vietnam War. He lives in Santa Monica, California. Supporting the Troops, A Dilemma with Many Questions. Each Sunday, Veterans for Peace places crosses at Arlington West on the Santa Monica, California beach in remembrance of U.S. war dead in Iraq. At the time of this writing, it was 1,127 and counting, he says. It's now over 2,000. It is a deeply moving sight as fallen soldiers are memorialized next to our historic pier. According to a Vietnam veteran, the memorial is not intended to serve as a political action. No matter what one's political beliefs, no one can deny the need to honor those who have lost their lives. Santa Monica's somber memorial is not a nationalist remembrance of our dead, as witnessed by a large cross and statement acknowledging the Iraqis who have been killed thus far in the conflict, more than 100,000 according to a recent British report. The staggering loss of life, however, is dramatically less than the estimated 1 million Iraqis who have died as a result of the U.S.-led UN sanctions that were put in place in 1990, supported by both major parties and Presidents Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2. In the current anguish over this conflict and desire to oppose the Bush regime, we may forget that far more people died in Iraq under the Clinton administration from those cruel sanctions than from the current invasion and occupation and the first Persian Gulf War in 1991. Santa Monica's memorial takes me back to July 26, 1969, my 29th birthday, when I, as an anti-war activist with Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, joined others as my Vietnam combat veteran brother presented an American flag on behalf of a grateful nation to the mother of his best friend who was killed in the war.
At the request of the family, my brother escorted his friend's body home on a journey from Vietnam to Rochester, New York. The mother and her daughters are part of my family. Therefore, my struggle with the dilemma of supporting the troops is not simply an intellectual exercise. I remain deeply torn by a support our troops view that avoids confronting the root causes for which they fight and die. How can we support those who take part in an aggressive and unjust war? What are we to think about U.S. soldiers who fought in other wars, the centuries-long genocidal assault against American Indians that destroyed their people, land, and culture? Would we support those who served with General Sullivan in 1779 as the Revolutionary War leader laid waste to the Cayuga Nation of the Iroquois Confederacy, a scorched-earth campaign that left crops and villages burned and thousands dead? How could we support U.S. troops in 1890 who took part in the last massacre of original Americans at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, where hundreds of Lakota men, women, and children were killed by the U.S. 7th Cavalry? Historian David Stannard tells us the survivors were tracked down for miles around and summarily executed. Women and children accounted for more than two-thirds of the Indian dead. That's from The American Holocaust, The Conquest of the New World, on page 126. In the 1960s and 70s, what did it mean for U.S. citizens to support the troops in a war that left some 2.3 million dead, 3.2 million wounded, and 14.3 million refugees throughout Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos? What about U.S. aggression in the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Grenada, Haiti, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, the Philippines, and Southern Africa? In these and other U.S. wars, did support for the troops help justify the policies of powerful Washington elites who were the ultimate war criminals in these unnecessary human tragedies? Can we support U.S. soldiers who execute policies condemned by the Nuremberg Tribunal in language that clearly places individual responsibility above merely following immoral and illegal orders? Troops who reject illegal orders are harshly punished by authorities, however, as we see from the few soldiers being court-martialed for refusing to kill in Iraq, and the thousands who resisted during the Vietnam War. If we take the Nuremberg Code to heart, however, should not those courageous soldiers who refuse unjust orders be the ones we support? If the war against Iraq is an illegal, immoral, and unconstitutional atrocity, how can we possibly support the Marine Corporal, one of a group of U.S. snipers that have killed hundreds of Iraqis in Fallujah, who coldly stated, "Sometimes a guy will go down, and I'll let him scream a bit to destroy the morale of his buddies. Then I'll use a second shot." With 24 confirmed kills to his credit, this Marine concluded, "I couldn't have asked to be in a better place. I just got lucky to be here at the right time and with the right training." From the Los Angeles Times of April 19th, 04. Millions of U.S. citizens are strongly opposed to the war against Iraq, and yet claim to support those who carry out the terror that it necessarily entails. Supporting the troops is not some abstract slogan, but a belief that must confront the concrete actions of the Marine quoted above, or another who stated, "We had a great day today. We killed a lot of people." It means supporting the thousands of troops who apparently embrace this mission. In the view of writer Arundhati Roy, it is a mission that will surely go down in history as one of the most cowardly wars, in which a band of rich nations armed with enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world several times over, rounded on a poor nation, falsely accused it of having nuclear weapons, used the United Nations to force it to disarm, then invaded it, occupied it, and are now in the process of selling it. That's from the Sydney Morning Herald of November 4, 04. Those who oppose this cowardly war wish to condemn it and support those carrying out the slaughter. Such a position appears to rest on the principle that U.S. soldiers' lives are more precious than Iraqis, a view that cannot be defended on any philosophical or religious grounds. Although one must acknowledge that many men and women have not truly made a free choice given the class nature of our economic draft, and the Marine quoted above and others like him have been trained as uncritical warriors by clergy, education, and mass media, virtually all U.S. soldiers in Iraq are executing their orders faithfully, rather than adhering to the Nuremberg Code and resisting the conflict. Conscience and law, therefore, obligate us to oppose both the war and the warriors, and move beyond narrow support to see the conflict for what it is, a crime against humanity. You have been listening to a reading of Dr. John Marciano's Supporting the Troops, A Dilemma with Many Questions. It was published in the spring of 2005. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York at Cortland and co-author of Lessons of the Vietnam War. He lives in Santa Monica, California.
Dynasty must fall. No kings in America. No kings in America. There is no American empire. The Bush dynasty must fall.